Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 22nd, 1999, and in the fireside room, Wes Howard Brook continues his Bible study on Revelations, and today it's called Messages from Beyond. This is tape 99-2.
I'm Wes Howard Brook. We're on the second of five sessions this week and 10 in the next 2 weeks on the book of Revelation, which we aren't really going to get to until Thursday. So I hope you're not too disappointed, although actually I'm going to read a few verses from it this morning. Part of my goal this week is to try and help us read Revelation with fresh eyes, to come to grips with some of the reasons why many of us have not read it, left it on the shelf as too strange, or where the dialogue around the book has been too controlled by the end of the world folks, presenting various kind of scenarios for a blueprint for the last days. Yesterday we looked in particular at the hows and whys of premillennialism, of that branch of Christianity that anticipates a literal thousand-year reign of Jesus that's preceded by the rapture. And we looked at what the appeal of that is, of what it is in our human condition in general, and what it is in our particular situation at this point in time that that kind of religious view is responding to. And we focused that down to two primary categories, time and evil. Within the question of time are many issues like, is there any purpose to my life? Will anybody remember me after I'm gone, or my works? What happens when I die? Is there any purpose to human existence on earth at all? Also, all those questions that relate to the future and the value of the past in relation to the future and my life in relation to the bigger history of humanity, questions of time. Questions of evil obviously relate to things like, you know, how do we live in the midst of an unjust world? Whose fault is it that there's evil? How will evil be confronted? Is it confronted by humans gathering our forces in war, or gathering our forces in nonviolent protest, or do we just sit quietly and pray? Is God really in charge? Is God concerned with the human condition and the presence of evil? Will God do something about it someday? Is God doing something about it now? You know, is God actively involved in the human situation, or is God just this spirit that's in the kind of in the background, watching passively while we work it out for ourselves? Those kinds of basic theological questions are obviously eternal human questions. They reach a certain fever pitch in our world because of the possibility of massive destruction of the human condition and of the earthly condition because of nuclear weapons or environmental catastrophe or other things that just simply weren't as powerful in earlier times. But they're not unique to our time. We looked in particular how the premillennialist response, the scenario of an end time, is almost uniquely, not absolutely uniquely, but almost uniquely an American phenomenon that comes out of our tradition of wanting to fix things and feeling very anxious when we can't, when there's a problem we just have to live with rather than being able to solve it. And as I mentioned yesterday, the war in Kosovo is just simply the latest of, you know, a couple centuries of examples of that, where we're very nervous when we can't just do something. Okay. So because premillennialism is popular, and many of us have not really looked at it, but just sort of heard rumors about the rapture and such, and we associate it often with the book of Revelation, which it's partly associated with and partly not, many of us have said, oh, that book of Revelation is too weird, and I don't know what it's about, and, you know, you read a passage from it, it doesn't make any sense, and so we put it aside. Today I'd like to look at some of the consequences of putting it aside, because the questions remain. Whether or not we look to the book of Revelation and the broader phenomenon of apocalyptic literature for possible answers or not, the questions of time and evil, the variations on those questions, you know, are really some of the basic questions of human existence, and they will not go away. We can deal with them by drowning ourselves in various addictions, whether that's drugs and alcohol, or work, or materialism, or status, or other ways in which we pursue endlessly, you know, self-aggrandizement or just activity to cover up the questions. We can look for easy answers in, you know, scenarios of just believe in Jesus and it'll all be okay. We can take the more difficult route of trying to engage the Bible in its own context, which is what I'm going to invite us to do as this week and next week goes on. But for many people, as we well know, the Bible is just simply not a place that people go. The book of Revelation in particular, for many Christians, but the Bible in general, for many agnostics or atheists, but also for many Christians. I find in the 11 years that I've been doing adult Bible study, how many churches I've gone to of every mainline denomination where people have said, you know, we've never really had any serious Bible study in our church, or not much. Maybe that's not true for any of you, but I hear that a lot, that the Bible is just not the place that people have tended to go when there's a crisis in their own life or in the world, other than in sort of the magical way of kind of opening up the book in desperation and finding a passage. It worked for St. Augustine, but for most people that doesn't help directly. So when those routes don't work, many people turn to other phenomena, and that's what I'd like to look at today. Not with an evaluation of their truth, but with the looking at why are they appealing? What are they appealing to? And what price do we pay as the Christian community in ignoring them? You know, why are they popular? Because maybe we haven't been doing our pastoral work as well as we might. To start with, I'd like to have us either look at or at least listen to a little bit of the book of Revelation. If you have a Bible, that's fine. If you don't, that's okay too. You know, Revelation says in the beginning, blessed are those who listen to this word of prophecy read aloud. So you can listen. But I want to read this just to a little passage here from chapter 1, starting in verse 10, to show what it is that John, the seer here, claims to be the source of his wisdom. What it is that is inviting you as the listener or reader to pay attention to what follows in the rest of this book. He says, starting in verse 10, I came to be in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a strong voice like a trumpet saying, what you see, write in a scroll and send it to the seven ecclesiae in Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. Just pause for a moment. I use the term ecclesiae, which is the Greek plural for ecclesia, usually translated as churches, for a couple of reasons of which we'll get at in more detail on Thursday and Friday. But for now, just to say that the word church carries so much baggage and connotation for us in terms of institution and buildings and all those things that have nothing to do with what's going on here, that I try and give some weight back to the original term. So you know, we recognize we're not talking about an established institutional religion yet. Okay. And then in verse 12, he says, I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me. Now, I hope you recognize how curious that is. I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me. And I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands, one like a human being, clothed with a garment to his feet, and girded around the chest with a golden sash. And his head and his hair were white as wool and as snow, and his eyes like a fiery flame. And his feet were like fine copper glowing in the furnace, and his voice was the sound of many waters. And he had in his right hand seven stars, and from his mouth a sharp, long, two-edged sword was protruding, and his face was like the sun when it shines in its power. And when I saw him, I fell dead at his feet. Now, if someone in your congregation, or your neighbor, or your child, or whoever, came to you and said they'd had that vision, what would your reaction be? Bad dreams?
Call a psychiatrist. Child of the 70s.
Child of the 70s. We'll get there.
What are you talking about?
Don't eat that tomorrow.
Yeah. Don't eat that tomorrow?
Okay. What drugs are you on?
Drugs, okay. Isn't it interesting that we, as I trust a Christian audience, when someone purports to have a divine vision, assume he's crazy? Not one of you said that your first assumption might be that he had a divine vision. Our first reaction is skepticism. First reaction is to not believe it. And as I mentioned briefly yesterday, the branding of people as mentally ill or crazy is, you know, a socially conditioned response to someone having an experience that doesn't fit the dominant paradigm. You know, when you've had something happen that doesn't fit what you're supposed to experience, the first thing is to say, call the psychiatrist, you know, who's, you know, the priest of the institution that decides who's crazy and who's sane. Okay? Why is it then, if our first reaction, if someone we know would be to assume drugs, insanity, 70s, I would have said 60s, but why should we listen to this guy, who we'll call John of Patmos, for lack of any more detailed description? Why do we think John of Patmos is reporting, or do we, reporting an actual experience that he wasn't eating too many mushrooms out there on the island, or something else? Real question. Why should we?
Well, perhaps his was closer to realism than revelation, the explanations in revelation.
Revelation is closer to realism?
No. The other way. Aren't you talking about Paul?
No, I'm John. The seer in Revelation. We presumably will start this journey into Revelation by believing that what he claims to have had as a divine vision was a divine vision, that he's not mentally ill. If we think he's mentally ill, then we might as well stop and do the John's Gospel or something else for a couple of weeks, you know. So if we're assuming that this somehow is the Word of God, whatever that term suggests for us, why? Why do we believe it when he says, I had a vision, but if your friends and neighbor had one, you think they're nuts?
He had pretty good credentials for his background.
What credentials did he have?
Was he not one of the apostles?
Mm-mm.
Well, I think we have a tendency to think that revelations or new information and stuff comes to us through the printed word, the speaking, and I don't think at the time of John that they had, all people couldn't read and they didn't have a lot of printed word, and so a lot of the message that came to them came in visions, and so we sort of doubt today. If they read it someplace, we'd believe it. But
okay. Now, as an author, I hesitate to say this, but just because it's in print doesn't make it true.
That's right.
You know, there's lots of junk out there in print. Not my book, of course, but I mean, as we know, there's lots of stuff out there, and even in the ancient world, there were many written documents that didn't make it into the Bible, whether it's the Gnostic collection that found at Nag Hammadi in the desert, or the big fat collection known as the Pseudepigrapha of apocalyptic literature, some Jewish, some Christian, that didn't make it in anybody's canon of scripture, but was part of the language of religion and religious texts in the first century before Jesus and the first century after.
But that's precisely the point, because this did make it into the canon. Somehow we assume that someone else has put it through the questioning, and they found it acceptable, so we dare to do that.
Okay. So simply be out of canonical authority, then.
Yes.
Nothing else other than it's in this book and not in some other book. Now, I hope we recognize what a shaky read that really is. You know, I'm obviously not suggesting you shouldn't believe it. I like this book of Revelation. I've come to like it, and, you know, here we are doing it for a couple of weeks. But I just wanted to have us come to grips for a moment with the fact that on its face, it doesn't say John was an apostle. There's some tradition associating John with anybody named John. Was a common name in the ancient world. There's John the Baptist, obviously, and John the brother of James, sons of Zebedee, and lots of Johns. It was a common name. He never says he's an apostle. And I guess I believe if he was one of the 12, he would have said so. It would have been a basis for authority. Paul, as we know, you know, wrestles strongly with his audience to insist he's an apostle, even though not one of the 12. He knows that apostolic authority is a powerful thing. If John had it, you'd think he'd claim it. But he doesn't. Instead, he says, I'm your brother, a sharer in the tribulation and the endurance. So I'm one of you trying to struggle through being a Christian in the midst of the Roman Empire. And there I was, and on Sunday, in the Spirit, I had this vision. I was told to write it down, and here it is. Okay. At the time, nobody knew it was going to make it into the Bible. That was a couple centuries later. And yet it was powerful from the beginning. And yet even then, lots of people had visions, and they didn't all make it in the Bible. There was something about this text that fit. We'll look at that more tomorrow when we look at Hebrew Scripture and how really there's almost nothing new in Revelation at all anyway. It's really just a summary conclusion to the whole biblical message. And other than the Lamb, which is a big only other. It's largely a bringing forward of 1,000 years or more of tradition in new language. But I want to point that out to say that we have this great divide in our minds between John, the biblical visionary, and modern people whose visions we're largely suspicious of, because I'd suggest we're creatures of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment has shaped our worldview at least as much, and probably as a practical matter more so, than the Bible has. For those, you know, not trained in such things, just shorthand, the Enlightenment, you know, is that intellectual movement in the 18th century that, you know, elevated human reason to a paramount status, you know, separated universities from the control of institutional church, and allowed for free thought and the development of scientific method, etc., that looks to evidence of our senses, empirical evidence, and reason to determine truth. Okay? Most of us, as a practical matter, that is our paradigm for truth. If we can't prove it, if it doesn't meet the evidence of our senses, we tend to be skeptical. But that isn't enough to answer the questions of time and evil, usually. You know, we can't reason our way to answers. So we look to something from beyond. And that's why we look to apocalyptic, to messages from beyond, from the other side of the veil, as we talked about a little yesterday, not using the word apocalyptic in the popular sense of violent or cataclysmic or end of the world, but in the biblical sense of something that lifts the veil, which, as I mentioned yesterday, has this mystical component, a visionary component, and a social and political component. Okay. The visionary component here is that we can't get to it without something coming to us beyond what we can reason and see and touch. And the social political component is that our perceptions have been clouded by a social world that's been imposed on us, that teaches us to see in certain ways. The Enlightenment is one piece of that. And there's also the more insidious things like advertising and such that teach us to see the world and ourselves in it in a certain way that we'll get to a little more next week for those of you who are still here. Okay. So what I'd like to look at for the time we have now are some of the more popular phenomena that substitute for apocalyptic, and the book of Revelation in particular, for people for whom the Bible isn't a source of wisdom. The first one I'd like to look at is near-death experiences. And I'd like to look at each of these, highlighting a particular advocate or analyst of the phenomenon who is expressly not a religious person. And look at who they think their audience is and how they think they need to explain this phenomenon to their audience. The first near-death experience I put up on the board here, the name of, I know it, when I first came in, I couldn't find a black pen, so you probably can't read this in green, but just to, so I can read it for you. The questions I'd invite you to filter all this through are, how do these phenomena respond to the desire for a message from above or beyond? This, you know, need for some authoritative voice to tell us an answer. And what response do they give to the questions of time and evil? How do each of these phenomena we'll look at? Near-death experience, UFOs and aliens, and New Age religion under the form of shamanism in particular, and if we have time, we'll get to Marian apparitions. So what response do they give to these questions, and how do they respond? So near-death experience, I'd like to focus on Dr. Melvin Morse, who's a Seattle pediatrician. He's written several very popular books. I don't focus on them just coincidentally from Seattle. Oddly, much of the stuff is focused around the Northwest. I'm not quite sure why that is. Seattle is a big place for channeling and near-death stuff. And I don't know why. Too many trees, I guess. But Morse has written several books, I'd like to share something about how he presents himself, and just imagine who his audience is. He says, you know, as a pediatrician, I'm a scientist. You know, I'm not a religious person, he says. He says, I have a violent allergy against anything that sounds New Age. What I'm trying to do is understand scientifically the part of our brain that can allow us to experience something that we tend to term near-death experience. You know, who's that? What audience is that appealing to, do you think?
Anybody who wants to know what happens after death?
Anybody, you said anybody wants to know what happens after death. You notice that the phenomenon is very carefully named near-death experience, not after-death experience, even though it's a slippery definition there. People tend to interpret it as it's a description of what happens after you die, even though by definition people haven't died. So the broad answer, anybody who wants to know, which obviously includes Christians and Jews and people of religious faiths and agnostics and atheists and others.
People who have been alienated by the church in some way, who have been burned or...
Okay. Yeah. People have been alienated or burned by the church in one way or another?
Any other? Scientific community?
Scientific community? And I'd say, if we look at the books, you see these are mass market paperbacks. These are not academic treatises. There are academic treatises on near-death experience, but I'm focusing here on the popular phenomenon. His books have sold literally millions of copies. And you know, you often see them in the grocery store or popular bookstores. So it's not just the scientific community in the sense of scientists, but people whose source of truth are scientifically based truths. Or at least what purport to be scientifically based truths. Okay. As someone said in the first session, the 80% of Christians who, you know, don't go to church or only go to church as a ritual, who don't really believe that there's a God active in the world or in their own life, but just do it because they were taught to do it as some kind of fire insurance, you know, so to speak. Okay. Throughout his book, and again, Morse isn't someone who had an experience. He's reporting and analyzing various experiences of others. He especially is focused on near-death experiences of children because he's a pediatrician. That's what brought it to him. He uses a very interesting term. He talks about the circuit boards of mysticism. Now, I think that's a very interesting techno-spiritual metaphor myself. You notice he didn't say the software of mysticism. It's a hardware thing here, circuit board. You know, he writes throughout his books about, and I counted in one of his books his use of that term six times in a 200 and something page book. I was curious, so I went back through it and counted, because I thought, I know he's used this more than once. Six times to try and, that's his paradigm. It's something scientific to explain this thing from beyond. I'm not a religious man here. This isn't about God. It's about your brain. And he chastises other scientists for being too quick to close their scientific inquiry to the possibility that the brain may have potential more than what we know so far. He chastises them for not being scientific, you know, because a scientist is supposed to be open until the evidence shows concretely that something is not true. You shouldn't assume it's not true unless you have evidence to show it. And he is trying very hard, and I'd say almost frantically. You read his rhetoric, sounds like he's trying to persuade himself as much as anybody else, or maybe it's calculated for his audience, it's hard to tell. But to say, you know, let's be scientific. Let's not slip into, you know, new agey stuff here. Let's focus on the possibility that our brain is more powerful than we know and might be able to invite us into these kinds of experiences. So that's one angle on near death. Now, obviously, he cares about this not just as an abstract phenomenon, but because, I think it was Jim up there, it's hard to tell in the reflection, who's saying, people whose question is, what happens when I die? You know, we're looking at this not just to see how a scientist deals with any old problem, but how a scientist deals with the possible solution to the question of time. What happens after I die? Okay. His answer is, that it makes people who've had near-death experiences become more compassionate, more loving, more concerned with others, what we might call more Christian. He, will, of course, will not say that. But he's interested because he thinks that maybe if we can tap into this part of our brain, we can become better people. We can improve humanity. And he shows that he really believes in the myth of progress. You know, one of the post-enlightenment phenomena that suggests that, you know, as we educate ourselves, life will just become better and better and better. And the philosophers and theologians threw that out, starting with World War I. And so, you know, in some circles, there's no law. The myth of progress is just that. It's a myth, a false myth. But Morse, you know, takes that as, you know, as we study more, we'll learn more, and maybe we can learn how to be better people by tapping into this part of our brain. Another piece about the near-death phenomenon. Another writer, many writers have written just about their own experiences, you know, these kind of conversion stories that are very popular. One of them which struck me when I was reading it was by a guy named Damien Brinkley. Like people, any of you know his work? Yeah, you've read that one. And I forget, several of these books are called Something by the Light, and I forget which exactly. His is called Touched by the Light or something, you know, which, do you know what it is?
I remember it.
Anyway, well, so you can chime in, feel free if you want, as I'm telling the brief story. But Brinkley, by his own definition, was a bad guy. You know, he was a bully as a kid. You know, he liked to beat people up. He's a liar and a thief and, you know, a nasty kid. He enlisted in the army to go to Vietnam. He liked being in Vietnam. You know, and he really got off on the whole destruction and violence thing. He came out of Vietnam and was an arms dealer, covert arms dealer, you know, bad guy. He was in his house one day on the phone and got literally struck by lightning. They thought he was dead. Obviously, he wasn't dead. He went through what's become the classic paradigm of near-death experience, the watching his body on the table and wondering what's going on and turning from it to the tunnel and going through the tunnel to the point of light. And on the other side is this being of light, as he described it, who was in this grand and glorious place and gave him a life review. His whole life flashed before him, scene after scene, and what he experienced was the pain of everybody he'd hurt in his life. There was no commentary. There was no demand for repentance or any kind of verbal interjection, but he just simply felt the pain of everything he'd caused, and obviously, by his own description, that was a lot. And then after that, to shorten the story, some other things happened, and he's sent back to take this message of hope and light that he's experienced. And in fact, his life did change. He started to work for people in hospice need and wrote books. Stopped being a bad guy, became a good guy. And in his book, you see that this incredible message for many people in our world, that no matter how bad and evil a person you were, you can come out okay in the end. Not because of any conversion in this life. You see, he didn't suddenly become a better person in daily life except for this near-death experience. Now, it implies that if he'd died, if it hadn't been his moment to come back, he would have still been okay after death. He would have had this painful, purgatory-like experience, and then he would have gone to heaven. Now, what a message that is, huh? No matter how nasty a life you live, you may have to go through some painful moment, but you still go to heaven. Everybody goes to heaven. Isn't that nice? How comforting. As a practical matter, I think that's what most of us, many of us, believe. Because we don't talk much about hell in mainline denominations these days. It's not very fashionable. It's a reflection of the culture around us. And to underscore that, I'd like to step back to a writer named Carol Zaleski, who's a Christian theologian, who's written both theological essays on near-death experience. She's got one called Near-Death Experience and Christian Hope. And she also did a comparative study of reports of near-death experiences in the modern world and in the medieval world. And you might not have known that there were near-death experience reports in the medieval world, but she dug them up. And what she shows, I think fascinatingly, is that near-death experiences reflect the cosmological paradigm of the world of the experiencer. And if that's too abstract a way to put it for you. You know, in the modern world, people like Damien Brinkley experience there is no hell. There's universal love and acceptance. Everybody goes to heaven. In the medieval reports, it wasn't the tunnel and the being of light and glorious heaven. The dominant description was of the person who thought they had died of walking across a creaky bridge and there are demon-infested waters below the bridge and an angel on the other side of the bridge. And the demons are literally trying to pull the person down in the water and calling out to them and trying to get them to lose their balance and fall in the water. And the angel is trying to get them to focus on them and get across. And she points out, that reflects the kind of Catholic, you know, cosmological structure of the medieval period. Of a heaven and a hell, and your life is about focusing on heaven and avoiding the demons of daily life and making sure you don't go to hell. Now in our modern world where people basically don't believe in hell, we have a being of light and tunnel, and everything's grand and glorious. As Zaleski says, in a little pithy quote I like, the being of light communicates but never excommunicates. So we have to question a little bit of the near-death experiences, you know, objective scientific kind of descriptions of some beyond, or are they somehow a combination of something that's out there and something that's in here that's either wishful thinking or a dream or who knows what? And she warned Christians in, you know, I think a very nice essay, you know, to recognize this is not an after-death report. You know, and counsels us to turn back to the Bible and our own tradition for what, you know, what we need to know about that, rather than, you know, the supposed, you know, geographical description of the place of heaven. Now, near-death experience in itself is not anti-Christian, obviously. Many Christian people believe in it, have read books and enjoyed it. It's given them hope. Many Christian people have written books about their own near-death experiences, and it's deepened their faith. So it's not a powerful antithesis, but we just have to be careful of recognizing it's not after-death experience that's being reported. But also recognize, for people like Dr. Morse, it's providing something that can be appealed to without any appeal to God or religion or the Bible or anything. Okay? Any questions about that before we move to a stranger topic? Feel free if you have questions afterwards at coffee break or something. Okay. I'd like to move into a broader area that some of you at this session from the El Cerrito Church, probably a bunch were in the early sessions, so you know Ted Peters, huh? He's a member of your church, I learned, and he's into this UFO stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not going to purport in about 15 minutes to say everything you ever wanted to know about UFOs. Or aliens or any of that. I just want to focus on the apocalyptic aspects of the phenomenon here and how it substitutes for revelation in the Bible for many people. This is just a little piece of trivia since we're in the Northwest. That the term flying saucer, some of you might not know, was the result of an experience over Mount Rainier in 1947. A pilot named Kenneth Arnold saw what he described as objects skipping like saucers across the sky, and the media misunderstood him and thought he was talking about the objects themselves looking like saucers. And so flying saucers, the term flying saucer was invented. It's not a totally irrelevant piece of trivia, because in the 19th century, objects in the sky that people thought were flying machines were described as cigar-shaped. It's a question of, you know, is this suggestive thought? You know, do you look for flying saucers so you see saucers? Or is it that, well, the aliens who were visiting the Earth in the 19th century had cigar-shaped ships, and the ones in the 20th century have saucer-shaped ships? That's one way to read it. Some of you may know, some of you may not, that the great psychologist Carl Jung wrote a book about flying saucers. In the 50s, because it was such a popular phenomenon in the 50s, he thought, you know, there's something going on here I need to deal with. And this book is simply called Flying Saucers, an analysis of things seen in the sky. And Jung, with great insight, as he usually had, interpreted the phenomenon in the 50s as a projection, archetypal projection of people's needs for something to provide answers in the world of the 50s of nuclear tests and, you know, the Cold War and other great risks to the stability of, you know, human race. And so they were looking up to the sky, hoping to see something that would help. Okay, that was back in the 50s when the reports were largely simply of objects in the sky. As time has gone on, there's much more of reports of not only seeing things, but, you know, the so-called close encounters of the third kind, and then close encounters of the fourth kind, which is physical bodily invasion by aliens, which has gotten to be its own little industry of publication and such. I don't watch Oprah and those things, but I understand there's a lot of those people on TV. Now, I want to focus on how that fits here to this apocalyptic paradigm. The extreme case is that people report that they were actually abducted, taken out of their home or some other place, and brought onto the spaceship, and had their body physically invaded, usually in some scientific sort of thing. They were told to take their clothes off and had something injected in, and they were explained in some telepathic or other way that their genetic material was being taken to be studied for the purpose of improving human beings. supposedly, and some of them not universally, that then the alien's genetic material would be inserted back in, or some kind of hybrid person would be born, and human beings would be advanced by this genetic gift from beyond. Now, what a wonderfully scientific and non-spiritual way to get a message from beyond that is. You don't have to believe in a god or a spiritual part of reality at all to believe that there's a more high-tech civilization than us who learned some lessons across history and want to help us. Covertly, perhaps, because they know that human beings' tendency is to take things they don't understand and kill it. Not to kind of come down and say, hello, we're here from such and such a place and we come in peace. But to do it in the middle of the night, quietly, place by place. Now, some people have tried to explain this phenomenon away, and some of it can be explained away. I want to point out that most of the people who report to have these experiences, and a recent study has shown that there's 3 million Americans who believe they've had physical contact with aliens. So we're not talking about some handful of weirdos somewhere. Almost all of them don't want to talk about it. They're not the National Enquirer types trying to sell their story for a buck. There are folks who know that it sounds weird. They know that it could affect their life largely in a negative way and don't want to talk about it. A lot of it's brought under hypnotic regression, and that's controversial in its own way. Some of that hypnotic regression experience can be interpreted as, suggestion by less than fully objective hypnotists. Others can be explained as screens for child abuse, and some of it probably is. This idea of someone comes in your bedroom at night and touches your body and the whole thing. But a lot of it cannot be explained that way. One of the people who's most troubled by that is Dr. John Mack, his name I've got up here, who's a Harvard psychiatrist, emeritus at this point, senior scientist, who has written a lot on this topic. And he said, I'm deeply troubled by this whole phenomenon. Because I was raised, as he said, as the strictest of materialists. As a scientist and as a person in his own family of origin and as a psychiatrist, to believe, the Enlightenment idea that only the material objects and the fruits of our senses are real. But he has a quote in almost the essence of apocalyptic. He says, it's as if life was this movie screen. And the alien experience is like a strong light shining from behind it, burning a hole in the screen. Now that's the essence of apocalyptic, The veil, life as a veil, that there's something from the other side that's trying to get through to us. Now, he's not seeing this in the light of apocalyptic, but it just shows how strong that sense is. That's the image that came to him. He's struggling with this. And like Dr. Morse, he's trying to figure out, can we explain it scientifically somehow? Is it simply that there's some kind of technological phenomenon that enables creatures to come to Earth in ways that our physicists, even though they say isn't possible, may be possible? Interdimensional travel or something you could sort of imagine that doesn't fit Einstein's laws? He doesn't have an answer. He's just got questions. But it leads him to wonder, and it leads him to start to wonder what most of us would think was a spiritual direction. Is there something more than what we understood? Could there be a God? Even though he's assumed that there isn't. Okay, that's one branch of the whole alien UFO apocalyptic thing. The other branch is the more expressly religious piece. And that reaches its pinnacle or apogee, depending upon how you look at it, in the Heaven's Gate phenomenon that I'm sure some of you recall from a few years back. That was Marshall Applewhite and Bonnie Lou Nettles, the folks who led the folks in San Diego to commit mass suicide so they could go up and chase the comet to heaven. That story in particular has some, cartoonish elements to it. And it was definitely a cult. It was a handful of people. But I think it's a representative of a number of other phenomena that together are a very strong phenomenon. This is what intersects some of Ted Peters' stuff. Ted Peters, for those of you who aren't from the Bay Area, is a theologian at GTU in Berkeley, and he's got an essay in a book called Religions from Other Worlds, which is a social scientific investigation of people who are part of various religious movements that claim to have their origin in creatures or beings from beyond Earth. Heaven's Gate you know, those of you not familiar with the intricacies of it, I won't get into it all. When you get back home, if you have internet access, its website's been replicated, and it's a fascinating thing to look at and read their story. But the long and short of it is that that Marshall Applewhite was a troubled person for a number of reasons, and he and Bonnie Lou were a couple. And after going through various stages of their life, they found themselves on the shores of the Rogue River in Oregon, another Northwest thing here. You thought it was all from California, didn't you? And suddenly, it was revealed to him, that's his language, it was revealed to me that Bonnie Lou and I were the two witnesses in Revelation 11. If that reference doesn't make sense to you, you can read Revelation 11 later. But not only that, that what it revealed to him was that they were half human and half alien. That their parents had been abducted and, you know, crossbred, and they were sent back to Earth as witnesses from beyond to help people understand what reality really was. But this was not about religion. You read the Heaven's Gate thing, and they insist this is not about religion. They claim to be as scientific as Melvin Morse, even though they committed suicide to get jump on board a comet. You know, doesn't sound that scientific, but there they were. That whole phenomenon of a religion from another world, you know, may seem really strange to us, and yet you can see how it can appeal to people who don't want to acknowledge some kind of spiritual dimension, but are still looking for something from beyond. Now, if you want to, you can read the whole Bible this way. Once you start to get the logic of it, you start to see how this is. Mount Sinai, for example. You know, Moses goes up on the mountain, and there's this cloud and fire and smoke, and he comes down with these tablets. Now, I ask you folks, which is easier to believe? That God handed them these two tablets out of nowhere, or that a spaceship landed and dropped them off? Why is it that we think it's easier to believe in the miracle than in the spaceship? Isn't the spaceship, you know, the less ridiculous solution than that the creator of the universe dropped off these two stone tablets with these words on them? Okay? So as people of faith, let's not write off other people's stories as being too weird. You can read much of the Bible this way. Elijah's departure in a fiery chariot. See, once you start to think this way, it's kind of obvious. You know, Jesus ascending into heaven in a cloud.
Or Ezekiel's room
from here. Ezekiel, you know, sure, you got the idea. See how it goes? You know, a lot of this was popularized in Eric Van Daniken's a book, Chariots of the Gods. And he and others, his book sold lots of copies. He was an ex-bartender and science fiction writer, curiously. Failed science fiction writer. But be that as it may, he got successful at something. So that's one way. You can take our biblical text and interpret it through the UFO phenomenon. But for those for whom the Bible is just not the source, new religions get formed that don't claim to be based on anything other than that there are creatures out there smarter than us that are trying to help us. Okay? We could go on with that. But just to give you some suggestions, some of it is weird culty stuff like Heaven's Gate. Some of it is incredibly popular stuff that is really the way most people, or the people within it, shape their lives, the dominant force. And they're looking for answers to these questions of time and evil. Any just questions on that briefly before I shift gears to New Age and shamanism? I realize we're doing just a little jumping around here, but it's the only way I can squeeze in an hour. Yeah?
When you were talking about the apocalyptic vision in our modern experience, I couldn't help but think of the Matrix, this idea of the veil.
I haven't seen it yet, but my friend Chad Meyer says you've got to see it and take Peter to see it too. So,
I mean, the whole movie's about that there's a virtual reality out there that everybody thinks they're in, and then there's a real reality underneath. And it's only a very few people who can see the real reality underneath.
That's it. You got it.
Yeah.
That's the apocalyptic idea. And we'll, tomorrow we'll look at its roots in Daniel, and we'll go back to Zoroastrianism to see where that came from. But yeah, it takes its form in modern movies. It's, you know, it's a very powerful idea, you know, that the Enlightenment doesn't, you know, to the extent that, you know, embody the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment doesn't want us to acknowledge as impossible, but that's why people like Dr. Mack struggle with, is the Enlightenment become a religion for me? Or is it a tool that's functional within a certain element of life, but maybe not all of life? And as people of faith, I assume we wouldn't give it total credence. New Age. I've got up here, if you can read my, can't read my writing here, the name Michael Harner. We'll switch from pediatricians to psychiatrists. Harner's an anthropologist and a self-described atheist. And he wrote in 1980 a very popular book called The Way of the Shaman, which was reprinted in a new edition in 1990 after it sold a couple million copies. And Dr. Harner's work was with indigenous religion and shamanism in Ecuador and other parts of Latin America. And he went off and, you know, as anthropologists do, studied the people up close and wanted to understand the shamanistic traditions of the indigenous folks there. And so rather than just asking them about it, he asked if they would take him on a journey out into the jungle and, you know, initiate him somehow into this tradition. And he tells a fascinating story about how they take him out, you know, on a trackless jungle, and he thinks that they've tricked him and just let this white guy out of the wilderness to let him die. They, you know, these old grizzled men, you know, walk much faster than he does through the jungle, and he loses track of them and is scared they've abandoned him, but they haven't, and it's just part of the process. And eventually, several days into the jungle, they stop and they mix up this brew of vines and they have him drink it. And his first reaction is they poisoned him. He thinks he's going to die. He thinks they've tricked me, they've taken me out here, they're poisoning me. But then he starts to have this series of visions. And, you know, they're very powerful visions and have all kinds of, you know, grand scenes, and I won't take the time to tell you the whole story. But in the course of the visionary experience, he gets a strong message that if he tells anybody about it, that he'll die. That it's a secret knowledge for him and he should not tell anybody. And he thinks he's going to die again, and they give him this antidote and he falls asleep. And when he wakes up, being the scientist he is, he's got to tell somebody, despite the sense and the vision that he shouldn't. And the only people he can tell out in this remote part of the Ecuadorian jungle are Bob and Millie, who are the local Christian evangelists at the mission station nearby. So the atheistic anthropologist is going to go to the mission station and tell the Christian evangelists about his vine brew-induced vision. And he tells them about it, and he gets to a certain part where he talks about this giant crocodile with water gushing out of its mouth, and Bob and Millie give knowing glances at one another and turn to the book of Revelation chapter 12 and talk about the dragon with the water flowing out of its mouth. They go, we know that story, you know. And he tells some more of the vision. They turn to a different part of Revelation, and it's all very fascinating. And what does that lead the atheistic anthropologists to do? To study the book of Revelation? Of course not. It leads him to study shamanism. It leads him to believe that in other people's traditions, there may be some path of truth. And he reads shamanism not as religion, but as a technique. Something that the theologian and writer Jacques Ellul would be very critical of, if you know the work of Jacques Ellul. This very title of book, The Way of the Shaman, is a manual to try and train kind of white, you know, American folks, not necessarily white, but, you know, dominant cult, non-indigenous people, you know, how to do this, how to induce a shamanistic experience and teach other people how to do it. And it's, again, sold millions of copies. In the preface to the second edition, he starts off in the first page saying, you know, the popularity of this book has taught me in 10 years that the hidebound dogmas of ecclesiastical texts no longer are ways of truth for people in the modern world. You know, an overbroad statement to be sure, but one that obviously is appealing from the first sentences to an audience for whom that's true, for whom the Bible in particular is not the source of wisdom. And it's so much so that even though he's had this experience that if he'd paid any attention would say, it's an experience just like John of Patmos had, doesn't lead him to give any credibility to John's visionary experience or to anything about the Bible. You know, as I mentioned to those who were here yesterday, you know, part of New Age popularity is to say other people's religions are interesting. Our religion is no good. Other people's religions are fascinating. You know, they don't come with the baggage of some people who were raised in different forms of Christianity and it was, you know, abusive in one way or another, or just didn't appeal. So he clearly thinks he's writing for people who are looking for something spiritual, perhaps, perhaps quasi-scientific. He never says he stopped being an atheist. But for something that gives them some hope. You know, the experience said to him, as horrifying as it was, that there's much more to life than meets the eye. And eventually he writes in this book about how the shamanistic technique can lead people to a place of peace and tranquility and harmony with itself and with creation, without necessarily providing any kind of doctrinal or dogmatic responses to the questions. Okay? Now that's just one piece of the whole New Age phenomena, but I would suggest he uses the term New Age there in his preface, and I think it's one of the sources of the term as it's used more broadly, for an amorphous blend of a little indigenous religion and a little Eastern religion and a little channeling and a little of this and that. That's anything except Judeo-Christian, anything except biblical. Okay, obviously continues to be very, very popular. And I think, you know, would be, I believe, less popular if we were saying, look, Book of Revelation is just as powerful as the indigenous religion of Ecuador is. And is our story, after all, not somebody else's story. Not to denigrate their story at all, but we have our own. Okay. Any comments, questions on that? If we have a little bit of time, I'll touch on Marian apparitions here in the last few minutes. But if you've got any questions, please feel free. If this means you're, it's all just blowing by you here, or if you're just digesting it. All right. Shifting gears slightly. Marian apparitions, I got into this category because my home is the Roman Catholic Church, and I was doing this for enough Catholic audiences that people would come up to me and say, have you been to Magicoria? And I haven't. And they'd say, when they'd launch on it, I don't know if you've ever met people who've been to Magicoria. Anybody here been there? Well, you don't even know where it is. This really is a Lutheran audience. Magicoria in Bosnia, where the children have been having for more than 10 years now daily visions of Mary and have written several volumes of books of their reports of their visions. Okay, you didn't even know what I was talking about. Let me write it on the board here. Since it's Serbo-Croatian, it's not spelled exactly as you might guess. M-E-D-J-U-G-O-R-J-E.
Is it a place or a...
It's a village that these visionaries had their experience of long before Bosnia was in the news. One of the interesting things about this particular Marian apparition, and I focus on this one because it's not one of those, you know, as someone was saying last night, do you know about the Marian apparition and the tortilla? Well, it's not one of those where it's just somebody's looking at a shape and, oh, there she is, right there between this rock and but where there's a series of visions that come with a message. And, you know, over the long haul, I mean, there's lots and lots. If you don't know about this, it's worth knowing about it just to be aware of it, not to believe in it or disbelieve in it, but just to be know it's out there. Literally millions of people have been to Magicoria in the last 10 years, and I'm sure at least 36 books have been written on it. I'm sure more than that, but that I'm aware of.
Hmm. Was the Weeping Madonna in France someplace?
Yeah, there are lots. That's a different story. The idea of icons and statues acting up, if you will, is a little different phenomenon. That's kind of within the category of stigmata and other things like that. Interesting, not apocalyptic necessarily.
What strikes me about the Medjugorje story that I know of anyway, and like Bernadette in the 1800s, 1700s, it's children.
Children, yeah.
And in Mexico, it's a slave who saw Our Lady of Guadalupe, right? A people in the power.
Yeah, the powerless, absolutely. And same with Fatima and Lourdes and the other major 20th century Marian apparitions.
Connected with healing experiences then too, or not?
Some are, and some aren't. Magicoria has been connected with miraculous healings and spinning sun and various other phenomena. I've never been there. I'm a little bit agnostic on it myself. I will tell you that I've met over the years lots of people who have been there, who went from various stripes of predisposition, from deep skeptics to, you know, credible people. I've never met anyone who didn't come back transformed in one way or another. You know, who didn't say, I know it sounds crazy, but... Now, whether you think of it like UFOs as mass suggestion, you know, if you go wanting to believe something, you can believe it. As I say, I've met people who went, you know, with their arms crossed and going, you know, prove it to me. Let me put my hands in, you know, her side kind of thing. Who came back saying, you know, there's something going on there. Whether it's God speaking through Mary, I don't know, but there's some spiritual power in the place. Now, I don't want to focus too much on Magicoria, except that it's current, it's still ongoing, so you might want to be aware of it. And it is curious that this obscure village in Bosnia, where they were told to build a church for this little, you know, village, which has since overflowed its bounds because of the number of pilgrims that have come, has been utterly untouched by all the violence that's taken place in that region in these years. And the message before the war, the Bosnian war started, was of the need to pray for peace and to act for peace and to engage in peace. So to interpret that as you will, that's just that's the phenomenon itself. I'd like to focus just for a moment or two while we have a couple minutes on the apocalyptic element of the Marian apparition piece. Because it's obviously a Catholic phenomenon and therefore, you know, religious phenomenon, not appealing like these other things to the scientific or the technological. It's appealing to a little different thing. And I think that's to the aspect that many people, who Catholics or otherwise, who call themselves believers, don't really believe that God is active in the world. You know, by default, I think most of us are deists. I'm not talking about you or you, so if you're not that way, you know, don't take offense. But I think many of our parishioners, our fellow Christians, are deists, you know, referring to the religion of our founding fathers, of believing in the Creator God who set the world in motion and then kind of stood back and watched. You know, kind of mechanic at the beginning of the assembly line, rather than the God of Moses in the Exodus, who's involved and participates in reality in powerful ways, who doesn't just use us as God's hands and feet, but can act independently of human beings. You know, as a practical matter, I think most of us don't really believe in that kind of God. We tell the stories, we sing the songs, but do we really expect that God can break through and do something? You know, some of that is that skepticism about visions. Our first reaction when the idea that God broke through in the simple way of speaking to somebody, revealing something to somebody, is to be skeptical and doubtful. Now, what the Marian apparitions do, I think, all the way back to Guadalupe, where it empowered indigenous people in Latin America and Mexico in particular, through a mode of communication that fit who they were. You know, the Catholic doctrine of the time didn't speak to those people. The vision of flor y canto, you know, flowers and song, that came out of the indigenous traditions, Aztec traditions, spoke to them in ways they could hear. And there's also, of course, the fitting in here of the vision of Guadalupe, the literal image that most of us may associate with the woman clothed with the sun, crowned with stars, fits very much the paradigm of Revelation 12 as well, the woman there. Not one for one, but much of it fits. So there's this visual image of this woman in that particular style that's the classic holy card of Guadalupe, that said to those people, God speaks to you in a language you understand. In the 20th century, I think, starting with Fatima in 1917 and moving up to Magicoria in our time, through children and through peasants, you know, through the powerless, it says, God doesn't just speak through church officials and theologians and educated people, pastors and such. You know, just like Jesus was a nobody, God continues to speak through the people that you're least expecting, you know, officially to be the bearers of God's truth, but for whom in our tradition, obviously, have always been the bearers of God's truth. And it says that God continues to be active. Now, the message, interestingly, Are there any other Catholics in this room? There were this morning. One, okay. You might know, if you're aware of the message in these Marian apparitions, is be a good pre-Vatican II Catholic. Obey the Pope, say your rosary, go to Mass as often as you can, go to confession, you know. Good 1950s Catholicism. It has the same kind of appeal, I think, that the premillennialist stuff we looked at yesterday did, which is to abdicate responsibility for doing something about the world. It says, God's in charge, and you need to repent, you need to pray, you need to engage in these pietistic practices, and if you do, you'll be saved. Okay? So it's the Catholic version of the Protestant believe in Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior. Believe in the Holy Father and the sacraments, and you'll be saved. And practice them, and you'll be saved. The Mary, as we were discussing, someone said this morning, the Mary of the Marian apparitions has an attitude. You know, she's kind of tough. She says, you know, my son is loving, but my son is, you know, got an iron rod too. And if you don't repent, he's going to come down in anger. And some of that is revelation imagery, taken kind of literally within the apparitions tradition, of Jesus coming back almost literally with a sword in judgment. For those of you here till the end of next week, we'll get to that. If you're not going to be here, I'm going to sign up if you're interested in the book to get more information or to buy the book when it comes out in September. I'd like to stop with one little closing anecdote about the relationship of these apparitions with the institutional church to kind of show back again right to the beginning of the struggle of where do we as ordinary Christian people fit in with revelation and with visionary experience as a means of hope. There was an apparition in San Garabandal in Spain in the earlier part of the century, in the 50s. There's a series of visions, again, to a young woman. And she said it was both Marian apparitions and angelic apparitions. And she said to the angel in one of them, I need some proof. They don't believe that this is real. How can I prove that you're real? And the angels, Angel Gabriel in particular, said, at a certain time in 2 days, I will appear for you by putting a host, a Eucharistic host, on your tongue for them to see. She gave notice. People gathered. You can see pictures in Marian apparition books, photographs of her sticking out her tongue in this white circle on her tongue. You know, you can explain it in whatever way you like. The institutional Catholic Church responded this way. It can't be a host because an angel is not a priest and an angel is not qualified to consecrate a host. True story. Okay, in anticipation of tomorrow we'll actually do some Bible study. We'll look at the roots of Revelation, especially in the struggle with the Seleucid Empire that is portrayed in the book of Daniel and the book of Maccabees. So if you can bring a Bible that has the book of Maccabees, it's part of the Apocrypha, so not all Bibles have it. If you're inclined, between now and tomorrow, you might read the first few chapters of 1 Maccabees and at least Daniel 7 and 12. For a little preparation. I understand you got a lot of other things to do, but if you'd like to do that, you're welcome to. I also, for some of you I think are from the Oregon, Portland area, I'd be doing a workshop that involves this stuff and contemplative prayer in interaction with a friend named Randall Mullins, who will be here starting tomorrow. He's a UCC pastor called Unveiling Empire Within and Without. That's through Journey into Freedom at the end of September, so if you're interested, those are here. And the book will be out September 17th. It's called Unveiling Empire, Reading Revelation Then and Now. And if you're interested in that, you can sign up here and I'll send it to you the day it comes out. Okay? Thanks so much. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow.